We'll do some background work today on Scribble. Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Don Wooten. Roll Tweet has the day off, but not George Eaton, Rock Island Arsenal historian. He's our guest today on Scribble. George, you work for the Army Corps of Engineers, Arsenal what?
Well, my official assignment is the Army Sustainment Command, which is one of the large commands on Arsenal Island. But because my boss, General Gamble, is who they call the senior commander, I also make sure I take care of Arsenal history as well. So internal to my organization and also the Arsenal's specific history.
How many different units are there on the Arsenal?
Well, I think the official number these days is about 60 different tenant organizations, that we call them.
You're kidding.
No, there's a huge number of small organizations. You know, people always think about just the plant, the manufacturing facility, but that's only about 15% of the population on there. So Army Sustainment Command, the First Army, Joint Munitions Command are some of the other big three ones. There's a large personnel center there as well. And then there's, of course, the Army Garrison, or so the mayor of all those organizations as well.
Boy, that's, how do you keep all that straight?
Years of just repetition and beating it into my head.
Tell me, what role does a historian play? Exactly what are you supposed to do?
Well, there's a couple different ways to look at it. So inside my organization, one, we are keeping the corporate history of what my command does. And my command really is the largest logistics command in the Army. It's a huge organization, global, with contracts. I think we're in 25 countries. Every installation in the Army has something of ours on it. So I keep track, what did that command do this year or last year, and how do we keep that straight? So that's one piece of it. The other piece of it, the Army has long believed that we can use history as training. So we can develop leaders by forcing them to think historically. So every situation isn't repeatable, but we can say, was there something similar to this back at a certain point in time? And the historian goes back and finds those different similar situations, and then can use those to help train new development, new leaders. So what would you have done? How could this have changed? What's the big flow of history that we're now working inside of? So we try to work on those sorts of leader development things.
Well, you know, one of the slanders they use is that generals are always fighting the last war rather than this war. So you have to be careful that you don't let history crowd in on you.
You do. And that's always been said that way. And there's a couple of good books out there that really – one book called America's First Battles always says, you know, how come we lose the first battle we always fight in this country's history? And the reason is often because – Our organizations, our training, our equipment has not been kept up with what other people are doing. So you have to be very careful about that. You're right. And say, what's similar? What can we use? But also what's – and then other people have to say, hey, this is what's different. And as historians, I'll always say, this is not a perfect replication. This is not a mirror. This is just using some historical example to inform and to help you make decisions.
When you do your work in history, are you serving the Army or your unit of the Army principally, or is there a public component to be served?
Well, I was going to get to that next. So I serve my unit. My unit is where I'm serving the Army Sustainment Command. However, we always in our regulation, because you know everything has a regulation in the Army, our regulation also says that I have a responsibility to tell the Army story to the local community, to help with celebrations, to help with commemorations, to, you know. But so because you know, the army is part of the country, and the population around us, those people in our area, they also can benefit from understanding how the army is, especially with such a small percentage these days being veterans. You know, it really, so we try to tell the story. Locally, we have this rich history from 1816, you know, forward from Fort Armstrong, and then the arsenal being created during the Civil War. And so we use that platform to talk to the local community and say, you know, we've always been here. We're this, you know, we've helped develop our community, and here's all the connections you have between the local community and the army that's been operating off of Arsenal Island for 165 years now, or 160 years.
Well, you see the site on Arsenal Island, and you think, of course, that makes perfect sense that this is a good place to have an arsenal. But how did it happen? I mean, you know, who had the bright idea? And because there were private developments on that island right in the beginning.
So it's a little convoluted, but from the time Fort Armstrong closed in 1836, and then there was a small quartermaster depot there that closed out before the Mexican-American War in 1846. It closed out. But after that, the Army didn't know what to do with it. I mean, they owned it, but and that's when all the other, you know, I'll be pejorative, all the squatters came in. And of those squatters were people like George Davenport and David Sears, you know, building the first dam and mills in the area, and all the work that George Davenport did as well. So they were there, but the Army always owned it. And so there was during the Civil War, there was this desire to have more arsenals. And in this case, it was mainly maintenance and storage further west to support the Civil War. At the same time, and leading up to that, you know, the Army was out in the frontier and they didn't have any place to go. So once the Mississippi River was a great barrier point and say, maybe we should have something on the river that can then project supplies and material out further to the west.
Well, this was the one place you could get across the river in the wintertime.
After 1856, we had a bridge, uh-huh, and the only bridge on the Mississippi. So they looked up and down the river. There were many, many nominations for where this facility should be, but they settled on Rock Island, one, because we already owned the land, and I think, two, because the rail was already here. And you already had this distribution network to get you across the river and get you further to the west. Mm-hmm. When the war was over, some people don't remember that we came close to blows with Great Britain during the Civil War.
Yeah.
And we were afraid of an invasion. And so after the Civil War is over, they decide to make this manufacturing complex here, trying to get some of that manufacturing off the East Coast and a place where it would be safer. And so that's when it changed from being supply and storage to being this great manufacturing complex that it then is built between 1867 and 1893. And all that construction that happened was to make a safe manufacturing complex that also can use the power of the water from the river to run the factory, and then has the rail network to mm-hmm. distribute the supplies wherever it's needed.
Yeah. You know, years ago when I was doing TV documentaries, I did one on the arsenal. And you're not allowed to have an overhead picture, but I found one in the Putnam Library. And so I did this, and it was a fluke. They were demonstrating a new weapon, and they called the three TV stations at that time to take pictures of this, and they gave each one of us something separate, you know, kind of a little bribe. Mm-hmm. And when I finished with my separate thing, I asked the guy who was with me, I said, "What do you do the rest of the day?" He says, "Well, I'm just supposed to take care of you." I said, "Well, what else can you show me?" And he let me into places I wasn't supposed to be. And I took pictures all over that place. And then when I finished with it, I got a call from the arsenal. Uh-oh. They said, "Could we have that kinescope? We thought that was excellent." So somewhere nice. In your belongings, you'll find that kinescope.
That's fun. Maybe down in the museum. I don't know. The resource center down in the museum that has the documents and pictures and stuff. Well, let's go back and take a look for that.
Do you have a relationship with the museum?
Well, you know, the museum has, you know, went through some struggles a couple of years ago, and we were afraid it was going to close. Now it's open. But part of that change over that's going on was they were trying to get the museum staff to be able to focus on the museum and, more importantly, focus on education so that we could, you know, more time talking to visitors who come in and things like that. part of that, there's this huge archive down there, and they decide the historian should have the archive. Mm-hmm. So, a stroke of a pen, and suddenly I was also responsible for that large archive. And I have had, I've had someone working in that archive now for over a year, 15 months, just trying to figure out what was in there. And of course, the old museum director retired in the middle of that, who knew where things were. And so now we're really, she was able to point us in the right direction before she retired. But now we're trying to see what's there, because our goal is to digitize all that so that it's easy for the local population. If they want to come and do research on find a kinescope, then there's going to be some sort of inventory document that says, yeah, we have one, and it may be digitized by now so we can actually share it with you. So that's something else I picked up in the past year and a half, is that responsibility. And it's a struggle because there's so much stuff in there and so many things that we're finding that we didn't know existed. Somebody knew existed, but we didn't as we're going through it.
Isn't it amazing what you can do with the stroke of a pen?
It's amazing.
I notice you're also in TV these days. How did that come about?
That was part of our talking to the community, letting the community know about military history. And so we've been on WQPT for maybe 6 years now, doing these two history minutes a month. And so we write a quick 59-second, which So I get to talk really, really fast on military history topics. And we started off really big Arsenal-focused. But after a couple of years, we started to spread out a little bit more to talk more about military history in general. So it's fun. People come up to me and say, I saw you on TV, and I'm always kind of embarrassed by that. But I do appreciate the fact that people are seeing it. And maybe they're learning a little bit about our Army and our military forces, and maybe they can feel a little bit better connection to them. Even if it's something that happened 100 years ago, they can still feel a little connection to the military.
It is illuminating to suddenly be on TV and be a public commodity.
I usually apologize. When they say, I saw you on TV, I say, oh, I'm sorry.
Well, I'm able to say you don't look old enough because it's been a long time for me. But that, doing writing something or even doing radio, but when you do TV, then it gets very complicated. Because you have to have the visual component.
Yes.
How do you arrange that? Does someone on your staff take care of that, or does WQPT come in and handle that?
So what we do is I have one of my history people research and write the basic script for the minute, and then come up with some images to support that. And then our public affairs office, we actually films it. And then we send the script, the film, and the images separately. I mean, all they film is me talking on a green screen. And then we send all that over to WQPT, and one of their editors then merges all that into one product. Mm-hmm. So the hardest thing for me is I usually talk totally unscripted. And, I just can't do that if I'm going to stick to 59 seconds. And so I have to write it, edit it, and then practice it 4 or 5 times to make sure I'm going to fall between 56 and 59 seconds, because then it's too long if I go over a minute for the station. So that's been the hard thing for me, is really scripting myself down and sticking to the script when I give one of those talks.
But I noticed watching it, you do talk very fast.
one person who stopped me in the street said that you talk so fast, but I can understand every word you say. I figured, okay. So we actually did try. We probably cut about a year and a half ago. We tried cutting about 20 words out of the script just so I could slow down a little bit more. And so if we try to keep that, we try to keep a little bit slower paced so that it's not quite, light speed that I'm talking.
What kind of a staff do you have?
Well, in my in the history office, in my command, we have me, and then we have two other people. So I have an assistant and an intern who we've just brought on to full government service. I happen to be lucky enough right now to have another intern. She only works about 15 hours a week while she's in school. So that's the staff. And then I have one other person that does the research writing for me, and that is not a government employee. That's a contract employee that does that. Work in the archives.
But you have this global responsibility.
Yes.
How can you handle that with a small staff?
It's very difficult. So we have seven brigades around the world. One's in in the desert, headquartered in Kuwait. One's in Korea, one's in Germany, one's in Hawaii, and three in the United States, continental United States. And each of them have a history officer as an additional duty. So it's not their prime job, something they have to do on the side. And so I rely on them to collect information and things like that. They have to write an annual history for their piece of the world and submit it to me, and then we combine it into the large annual history. And that's not enough. So we work hard with the public affairs officers who have the cameras and can write stories. And then I also try very hard to get to each of my units once a year. And then we try to do some oral history work, take some pictures ourselves so we can see the context of how they're operating. But it's always, to me, it's always a shoestring operation that we're collecting what we can.
Well, that kind of happens, doesn't it? I was the public affairs department at WHBF-TV, and I was the only one in the department.
Yes. And you know, you can't do it with one person. I was by myself for quite a while, and I just finally said, you know, we're missing too many things doing it by one person, and I can't balance anymore our local community responsibilities with our organizational responsibilities. And so they gave me another person, and then somehow I picked up these interns along the way. So it is hard. And digital makes it easier and harder, both, because if somebody produces a document, they can send it to me. I don't have to go, you know, get it from them. They can just send it to me by email. But we delete too many things now that are all digital. We don't have the carbon copies anymore and things like that. So we lose documents as well. It's really a two-edged sword being so digital. But it is nice. I can say, hey, send me that. Send me that thing that you did, and they can send it to me by email, and I have it, and I can save it then and archive it and make sure we have it as a document for the future.
You know, the odd thing is nothing is more permanent than paper.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it is. And if you digitize something, the flaw in that whole thing is they keep updating. And the first thing you know, you have a store of things that you can't see.
Absolutely.
And you're stuck. And the big mistake that a lot of offices make across the state is they all want to go to digital.
Yes.
And we, you know, paperless. And the authorities tell them, no, don't do that, because there's been, I know of at least one example where they did that and they lost valuable records that you cannot lose.
Correct.
And they're gone.
They have a crash or something like that. So,
yeah.
But just even the hardware, we found a couple of years ago about 100 U-Matic tapes, you know, which was that.
Oh, yeah. I have some of those.
But we had to send them off to get them converted. We didn't even know what was on them. So I had to pay money to find out what was on them so I could decide if I should save it or not. Last summer, I had a volunteer come in, and we found that we had over 300 16-millimeter films. And so I had this poor volunteer, and I found and repaired myself a 16-millimeter projector. And I had that poor volunteer watching these films to say, what's on it, and should we keep it or not? And then in the future, we'll try to digitize it, and so we can put it into a, you know, MP4 format. So, and I found an old Windows computer in an attic that had a 5.5-inch or 5.25-inch floppy disk, and I grabbed that. And I remember just enough DOS commands to save it on, you know, so I could save the data. It just frustrates you so much because things change so often, and then you're stuck again without being able to save things.
I have some rather valuable stuff on U-Matic tape, and I do have a U-Matic recorder, but it needs repair, and I can't find anybody who knows how to repair it.
Nobody repairs them. So.
Yeah, so you can really be done in by technology.
You can.
There's nothing like paper.
That's right.
How did you get into this business?
You know, it's interesting. So I'm a retired Army officer. I went to Knox College down in Galesburg on ROTC. And when I got in the Army, after about 3 years in the Army, one of my bosses said, you really should go think about teaching history at West Point, because I had a history degree. And so a couple years after that, I applied and I got selected to teach history at West Point. And so the Army sent me to graduate school for 2 years. And then I went to West Point and I taught military history for 3 years. And then I went back to my regular Army career and served other places and ended up here on the arsenal as an active duty officer. And I retired. And so when the historian retired, here I was. I was a veteran. I had the right qualifications, and I got the job right away. I never intended to stay, you know, around the military working, and all of a sudden I got this chance to do it. So I've gone down to Knox College and talked several times and said, you know, just because you don't get the job, you know, of your dreams now, you know, maybe down the road, if you keep working at it, the job of your dreams. And that's what I tell people. I mean, being an Army officer was a great job, but here suddenly 20 years later, I was able to be a historian again. And that was really just a great stroke for me to, and I got a chance to stay here and settle my kids down and things like that.
You know, it's interesting, the twists and turns your life can take, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes, it is.
And what is your big project now? I mean, obviously, no matter how you slice it, doing a TV thing is a big project. What are you working on that's where you spend most of your time?
Well, my own responsibilities have morphed a little bit over the past year or so. But in the history world, because we were shorthanded, I'm just trying to get us caught up to the things the Army expects to do. And then I really am working hard on the archives. You know, how do we take this paper and this 60mm film and what's a business plan that's you know, cost effective way to start to convert these things so that we don't have I don't want to have to worry about keeping a 16mm piece of film soft so it'll play. I want to digitize it and get rid of it. You know, send it to the National Archives. I don't care, but let them worry about it. But I still have the content. And so that's really my big focus has been the past couple of years is taking all that stuff I got from the Museum Resource Center, taking all my own archives and these things we keep finding and getting that into a safe, preserved state so we don't lose any more of that information.
Talking to you, I have this sinking feeling. I have many dozens of kinescope reels, 16mm, in what I hope are airtight red containers. But I bet if I open them up, they crumble to dust. I saved all those documentaries I did for Channel 4, and I think, I don't know.
Yeah,
talk about keeping film soft. I'm afraid to look at them.
It is. You know what? 2 years ago, we dug up the time capsule when we celebrated the 200th anniversary of Fort Armstrong. And this time capsule had been in the ground for 50 years. And so we were a little worried about it, but they did a good job. There was no water in it. Everything was in great shape that was inside of it, including a 16mm film on the 150th anniversary celebration. And it was perfect. I mean, we opened it up. It had been taped, and it was in a nitrogen-charged, you know, container. We opened it up, and it was great. We could play it. A year later, it's crumbled. We can't, you know, we're losing it right now. So that's actually one of the things that I took myself downtown and got digitized before we lost it, because I wanted to keep that one piece. So, you know, it's expensive to digitize, and I got to protect the taxpayers' dollars. So we're trying to find the right way to do this without costing too much money, because it could cost us a ton of money to digitize everything we have.
So what is an average day for you? How do you fill your time?
I think an average day is, of course, there's always too many emails, and our emails come from around the world because we're spread out everywhere. And then I try to go down and talk to my different sections that work for me now. It's the historian. I have a couple of the sections that work for me now, and just talk to each of them one-on-one, you know, as a manager, see what they're doing. And then I try to sit down for a while and think about here's the short term. What's the longer term? What do we need to be doing next? And that's always the hardest part, because it's just little crises pop up, and now I try to figure out what's the hardest part. I try to do a little bit of history research every day. Often that doesn't happen anymore because too many other things going on. And then we try to write something every day, write down something of importance to the command that we can make sure that we're saving as we go day in, day out. And every day we're saving something. Every day we're saving someone's situation report or briefing or things like that and adding to the archive. So it's really a lot of small tasks and that we try to do. Right now, my people are working for me. I'm beating them over what we call the annual history. You know, it's got to be done by a certain point. You're behind. I want it done by July. And that really does take – it takes maybe a couple months just to do that annual history, because we have so many units out there around the world that it just becomes a huge editing and compilation process.
And you have people interrupting you to come do radio interviews.
Oh, radio and TV both.
But, yeah.
these are the things I like. You know, we also do a lot of talks. We're doing a World War II history series with the Rock Island Library and the Davenport Davenport Library System, and we're trying to pick up the Fort Byron Library System. We did a World War I series for the past year and a half. And that's a great thing. We love doing that because we get out in the community and we talk to people about a history topic. And so that's another thing that we do a lot of, is go out to the community and give talks.
George, you're retired and yet you're working again. How much longer are you going to keep this up?
2.5 more years or so, I think. I have a goal, and the goal is 40 years of active federal service. And in about 2.5 years, I'll hit that mark. So that's sort of my goal. And then I won't be ready to quit, but I think I'll be ready to do something other than work for the Army. It's been a great 38 years so far, but it's time to try something else maybe.
Well, as a historian, you're kind of obliged to write some kind of major history, aren't you?
I'd like to finish my PhD dissertation, which has been lingering for 25 years. So I do have some big research writing projects. Some are military, some are because of my current job, some are other outside interests, and I would like to get to that eventually. So,
what is your PhD thesis?
I've been writing a biography for a long time of a guy named Walter Krueger. Walter Krueger was the commander of the 6th Army in the Philippines during World War II. So he was General MacArthur's senior ground commander.
I've seen his name.
And because of the way General MacArthur was, people don't recognize General Krueger. And not only World War II, but he was really instrumental to how the Army got ready for World War II in the interwar period, but in the 1920s and 30s. So that's what I've been trying to do, is write about him. So, you know, if I get 10 pages a year written on him, I'm happy, because it just takes, I have to restart every time. Okay, what are we going to research this time and go find it? The nice part is so many things are now online. I used to have to go to the National Archives to dig out, and now I can actually find them online, so I can do some research from home.
You know, I'm of two minds about that. In a way, it's really great that you have this opportunity to go online. But I kind of miss digging around in books, because digging around in books, you'd be led astray in some interesting ways.
I used to, when I was teaching over at St. Ambrose, I used to, for papers, I used to require the students to have at least two of their sources be from a written book. And they would come, and they come and say, you know, I went to the library and there was this book on the shelf, and there's other books left and right of it. I said, yes, yes, good, exactly what I wanted. Because I do love books. I love it more than online, but at least you can get focus. You can find what you need in general online, and then it helps you focus your research when you spend your pennies to go to the National Archives, say, to really zero in on what you need.
Well, now, obviously, if you're working on Krueger as a PhD project, there's your book.
There is, and I've got about 150 pages written. So somebody else has written a book on him since I started, and I think they missed the point on a couple of things. Generally a good book, but I think they missed the point on a couple of things, and so I'll focus it on those things that I think that I can explain better.
Well, you know, every history you read, you know, quite often you have critics rashly say, this is the definitive story, and I think there is no definitive story. You can't cover everything, no matter how thick the book is, and so there will always be other versions.
Something else will always pop up that'll help illuminate clearer what you were trying to say or what you thought. I have found that. I mean, I hope I'm big enough to say that I was absolutely wrong on some stuff, and I have been. You know, on some sides, like, whoa, I've thought that for 20 years, and now I have to change my tune because I found something else that says I was wrong.
Well, I doubt that you're going to be wrong, but that's about all the time we have today. Thank you very much, George, for spending the time with me today. And thank you for listening. I'm Don Wooten. Roll Tweet is off today, but he'll be back and Scribble goes right on. So I hope you'll join us next week for the next edition of Scribble.